what's happening in the Middle East and what's happening in Israel affects us today. And your book does such a great job of showing us how Judaism plays a prominent role in what affects us in our salvation.
That's the theme of the book, how central Judaism is to the entire unfolding of salvation history.
Well, and Bruce had mentioned that you had studied under some prominent rabbis, and one in particular, Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, as taking theology classes at Creighton University here in Omaha, his book Judaism was one that was a required reading.
Yeah, he was probably the foremost single rabbinic figure of the middle 20th century in the United States. He was an advisor to the presidents when they wanted, you know, the Jewish point of view. He was very well published, the head of the American Jewish Congress, and it was quite a privilege to have to sort of be his disciple, to have him mentor me growing up.
This particular book is not a book that Catholics necessarily think. It's not a paradigm they usually think of, that salvation is from the Jews. And why did you feel it was important to write a book like this?
Well, first of all, let me not exactly apologize for the title, but in case anyone's not aware of it, it sounds incredibly pompous or pretentious to say salvation is from the Jews, especially coming from me, a Jewish convert. But my excuse for that is that, of course, those are the words of Jesus himself in the Gospel of John 4:22. He says to the Samaritan woman at the well, salvation is from the Jews. And why I felt that was important to write a book about, maybe in a few moments I can tell how I ended up being Catholic, but essentially, having grown up Jewish and very Jewish, very the center of my identity being Jewish and very proud of being Jewish and taking Judaism very seriously, when I became Catholic, I thought this was the neatest thing in the world. Judaism was a million times more important, you know, incomparably more central to the entire relationship between God and man than I had any idea as a Jew. I mean, it just blew me away that Judaism is far more exalted through the lens of Catholicism, because obviously in Christianity and Catholicism we see that Judaism was essentially the relationship between God and man that God established with a chosen people, with a special people, to prepare for the incarnation of God as man, as Jesus, and bring salvation to all humanity. I thought it was a very exciting story.
Well, and it is. What I found very compelling about it, you show how Judaism continues to play an important role in our salvation history.
That's right. The easy part, in some sense, is the role of Judaism leading up to the first coming. That can be fairly straightforwardly, you know, thought through, that God, if God was to incarnate as man, he would be incarnating to a particular people at a particular point in time, and those people would have to be prepared for the incarnation, to recognize it when it happened, to support him when he was here, to spread the faith after he died, and so forth. And so that can be logically thought through fairly simply, in a sense. But then the very interesting and mysterious question is, okay, if that was the role of Judaism in bringing about the incarnation, does Judaism still have a role to play between the first and second coming? And that's, of course, sort of the bulk of the book, and is also a very, you know, tremendously exciting and interesting topic. And I think now, especially in this period after the Holocaust, with the rise of Islam, and with the reestablishment of the State of Israel and the tension in the Middle East, we can really get some sense of the continuing central role that Judaism might have to play.
Well, talk to us about the Jewish drive to remain separate, that there seems to be this great desire to remain a separate people.
Well, there's certainly one fairly straightforward angle to look at that from, which is, in some sense, put yourself in God's shoes 4,000 years ago, when he knew that he was going to have the second person of the Most Holy Trinity incarnate as a man in the future among a particular people, and that people would have to be prepared. They would have to be kept separate from the pagan idols. They would have to be catechized in the necessary levels of morality and so forth. They would have to know about the one true God. They would have to, you know, be taught enough to worship him, and they must be taught enough, have enough divine revelation to be expecting the coming of the Messiah and to be able to recognize him when he came. And this is now a nomadic tribe, you know, an insignificant nomadic tribe in the Middle East, swarming, you know, with peoples always warring with each other, always always intermarrying with each other, always in some sense dissolving among each other. Mm-hmm. This people would have to be kept separate for thousands of years during this period of preparation. So it's easy to imagine that they should be given the particular charism of an extreme insularity, a real tremendous internal drive to keep themselves separate and not intermingle with the others, because if they intermingled with the others in a few centuries, they would disappear and they wouldn't be there available to serve God for the incarnation.
Well, and it's from this the fruit from this isolation, for lack of a better word, isolation, but because of this, the incarnation was able to occur in a young Jewish woman.
That's exactly right. Well, and that people was successfully prepared, and that woman was raised to such a height of purity and nobility of spirit and you know, morality, immaculateness, in fact, that she was worthy to bear God in her womb.
Is the book aimed at Christians or Jews or both?
Well, the easy answer is both. I wrote it with a hope that it would affect Jews who read it, and it has. Some have entered the church when they see that how perfectly Judaism and Christianity tie together, how Judaism is logically the precursor of the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church is logically, essentially, post-Messianic Judaism. But it's also had a profound effect among Catholic readers. I've gotten hundreds of letters and emails from Catholic readers who have talked about how it's, in some cases, actually brought them back to the church when they were away from the church, but in many cases reinforced their faith, made them see the inevitability and the total truth of Catholicism for the first time, made them see why they should be interested in and excited by the Old Testament and the history of the Jews, and lots of feedback from that, too. So it's definitely aimed at both.
What I found fascinating, too, was that it connected. I wish we had time to go over a fascinating 2,000-year history of Judaism in the last 2,000 years from the destruction of the temple, which was a very significant event in the life of the people.
Yes, and also in the meaning of the religion itself, because, of course, from a Catholic perspective, we know that the Jewish sacramental system really did have salvific value until the Passion of Christ, and at the time of the Passion of Christ, the means for the taking away of sin was shifted. This is the letters to the Hebrews, among other things, in the New Testament, was shifted from the temple sacrifice to the sacrifice at Calvary and the holy sacrifice of the Mass. And so it's only logical that shortly after the crucifixion, the temple should have been destroyed and physically the temple sacrifices ended. But of course, when that happened, the Judaism as defined by God in the Old Testament basically could no longer exist because it was dependent on the temple sacrifices. And so it had to be, in some sense, reinvented for the world after the temple. Now, we know as Catholics that reinvented Judaism no longer had the salvific value that the Judaism leading up to Christianity had.
That is so significant because, again, the animal sacrifice was for atonement of sin. And then when the temple is destroyed, that can no longer occur.
That's right, but it actually could no longer, it physically could no longer occur, but it no longer had the effect of atonement of sin as of Good Friday.
We go ahead 2,000 years to the event which is so significant and so present in our memories of that of the Holocaust. The term you point out that Eli Wiesel pointed out that it was, he was alluding to Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac, the Holocaust.
That's exactly right. Now, that's obviously an extremely complex issue, and I draw several conclusions from it. One is that it's a reasonable hypothesis to say that Judaism exhausted its role in salvation with the first coming of Christ and is sort of irrelevant to salvation history after the first coming of Christ.
Right.
And I would argue that the Holocaust itself is a disproof of that because the forces that led up to the Holocaust, the rise of Nazism, flow directly from diabolical practices, from, among other things, Hitler himself was an active Satanist, and everything that flowed into the rise of the Nazis was so clearly diabolical that one is left with the question, if Jews no longer had a special role in salvation history, why should the devil be so focused on attacking them through history and most dramatically with the Holocaust? So that in itself is an indication. Another indication we have from Scripture, which is explicit, is that the Jews will be around at the time of the Second Coming, and the Second Coming will be shortly preceded by a wide-scale conversion of the Jews, which then is a scriptural basis for understanding that there is at least that relationship between the Jews and Judaism, i.e. their conversion and bringing about the Second Coming. And so then that raises the question of in what sense might the Holocaust have been a Holocaust, in other words, played into the role of salvation history. And that's obviously speculative, but as you point out, shortly after the Holocaust, the Jews themselves, or I should say we Jews themselves, did have a sense of some tremendous spiritual import to that. And I can't help feeling that in some mystical, mysterious way, the sacrifice and suffering of the Holocaust might in itself be related to bringing about the grace of the Second Coming in some way vaguely parallel to the way the sacrifice of the innocents under Herod was related to the grace of the First Coming.
It is. In your book, you have passages which we don't have, unfortunately, not enough time to go into, but the rise in the nations of Nazism and the role eugenics plays.
That's right. And in fact, Margaret Sanger's precursor organization to Planned Parenthood, the American Birth Control League, was actually actively involved. Let me just quickly interject.
Sure.
If people are interested in some details, which we won't have time to bring out over the air, I do have a website, www.salvationistfromthejews.com, which has a lot of information on the book and background information, accounts of my own, conversion story, and even a way to order the book over a link. So they can always turn to that if they want to fill in some of the blanks.
I think it's important to note, too, that you point out to us, with anti-Semitism occurring in Germany at that time, the lack of response by nations, what Hitler was doing to the Jews, it was known, and it was like a slippery slope. They just took a little bit more and a little bit more. And the fact that nations didn't, you point out as an example, the 1936 Olympics, the fact that the United States didn't boycott, even though these atrocities were occurring.
Yeah, and Jews were officially banned from the town where the Olympics were being held. I mean, that was official known policy, and yet there was no response to that. And Hitler was consciously testing the waters. I mean, he was continually increasing the heat and waiting to see if there would be a world reaction which would cause him to stop. And at each escalation, he realized that there wouldn't be any opposition.
That's right, and that's what's so sad about what's happening today, because those kind of things, if you look at it through those lenses, are happening today, especially in the Arab nations.
That's right. Of
anti-Semitism, as you point out, the reinventing of history and the indoctrination of their children through their textbooks.
That's right. I think that, and I go into, as you know, a fair amount of detail in the book, but it's easy to have a sense that the same spirit that was at work in Nazi Germany has not died and is still influencing parts of the Islamic world.
And then again, in your book, you're very careful not to say that these things are actually happening. But when you talk about the Jews in the Second Coming, that there are certain elements that seem quite a paradox. I mean, with first the Jews returning to Israel, that was a significant event. And you point out that needed to happen when you look at passages written concerning the Second Coming.
That's right. I mean, it's always dangerous to try to be too specific about biblical prophecy, so I try to leave it up to the reader, but what I do is I just pull out relevant passages of Old Testament and New Testament prophecy and kind of juxtapose them, line them up against events of the last 50 years so that the reader can draw their own conclusions about how well they feel it might tie in.
Right, and then you point out that two-thirds would be wiped out.
That's right. There's a prophecy, I think it's from Zechariah, that two-thirds of the people would be wiped out, and exactly two-thirds of Europe's Jewry was wiped out during the Holocaust.
Right. And then again, the nation being born in a day.
In a day. And Israel was literally, it's rare that a nation was literally born in a day. But Israel was born in one day when the UN resolution was passed to establish the State of Israel in 1948.
Right. And that the new state would be prosperous.
That's right. It's easy to see the resonance of those prophecies in what we're seeing today.
And then you go on to talk about that there will be, according to prophecy, if you look into this, a fight over Israel, over Jerusalem, and that would lead to world war.
would in fact, yeah, that's right, lead to Armageddon and the second coming.
And we look at the news today with all those other things lining up, especially with the tensions that are occurring, that is not an impossible notion, is it?
No, it's an easy scenario to imagine. It's also very easy to feel the poetry in some sense if a fight over Jerusalem, in some sense the holiest place on earth, because it's where, when God became man, where he walked and where he died and where he bought the redemption of the whole human race, if that should be the flashpoint, the trigger point to bring about the great conflict between the forces of the Antichrist and the forces of Christ, which would culminate in the second coming, it would certainly be sort of poetically appropriate.
Well, and a really important point you bring out is the conversion of Jews. And you demonstrate how that is beginning to happen. And one of the examples that you use is Edith Stein.
That's right. It seems to me that in some sense she was a watershed. She gave her life in part. She wrote out a consecration offering her life to God for, among other things, the conversion of her people. And there's been a tremendous amount of conversion of the Jews after her death, and especially in the last 15 years. There is now not a single town in Israel without a Messianic Jewish congregation. There are about 200,000 Messianic Jews, in other words, Jews who have come to Christianity, in the United States now, up from, you know, maybe 500 in the late 60s. There are half as many Messianic Jews in the United States as Orthodox Jews. In other words, for every two Orthodox Jews, there's already a Messianic Jew in the United States. I do think something is happening, and this all, you know, it's easy to see this resonating with the biblical prophecy.
Now, you had a rather dramatic conversion experience to Catholicism. We've kind of been going through all the Q&A and things in the book, and would you like to share a little bit of,
sure,
of that with
us? I would love to. At the time this happened, I was in my early 30s. I was had been appointed to the faculty of Harvard Business School at 29. I was a young Harvard Business School professor. I had externally sort of felt like I was on top of the world. I had gotten everything that I, you know, had ever really aimed for, or even more than I expected ever to get. It's obviously a very prestigious position and associated with a more than comfortable amount of money and a lot of ego gratification. Mm-hmm. And rather than being happy and content inside, I found myself in more despair than I had ever been in my life, because all my life I had had this thirst for real meaning, like there must be a real point to something. Things would have to have real meaning to be kind of worthwhile. And I kept thinking that later in life, you know, I'm going to come into the meaning. I'm going to find the meaning. It's going to come when I'm a grown-up, or it's going to come when I make, you know, enter my career or whatever. And as each of those stages was reached, it didn't scratch the itch. There still was not any intrinsic meaning. And at this point in my life, there was no more success to hope for. There was no more change, really, to look forward to. And yet, nothing mattered. I was essentially, at this point in my life, somewhere between an agnostic and an atheist. You know, I didn't believe in God or in the afterlife or anything, and nothing in the long run had any point. And it was in this mood that I was walking in nature early one morning, and I received the most singular grace of my life. I was just walking along, and from one instant to the next, I found myself very knowingly, consciously in the presence of God. I felt him with me, and I looked at my life as though I were looking back on my life from after death in the presence of God. And I saw in an instant how I would feel about everything. I saw everything that I would be happy about having done and everything I would have wished I had done differently. I saw that everything I had ever done had a moral content that mattered for all eternity, that everything I had ever done was actually observed and weighed in the scales in that sense by this God. I saw that we lived forever, and I saw that my two greatest regrets when I died would be all of the time and energy I had wasted worrying about not being loved, when every moment of my existence I was held in a sea of love greater than I could imagine.
Wow.
Coming from this all-loving God. And the other great regret would be every hour I had wasted doing nothing of value in the eyes of God. And so from one moment to the next, I knew everything I had ever wanted to know. I knew the meaning and purpose of life, and that life had far, far greater significance, far more meaning and purpose than I had ever dared imagine or hope for. What I didn't know is who this God was. So I sort of prayed on the spot, let me know your name so I can know what religion to follow and how to worship and serve you properly. And I remember praying, I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan. I don't mind if you're Buddha and I have to become Buddhist. As long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian.
Oops.
So given that I was praying that, I was obviously unwilling to hear that he was Christ. So he did not reveal that to me. But after that experience, every night before going to sleep, I would say a short prayer to know the name of my Lord and Master who had revealed himself to me. And a year to the day after the initial experience, I went to sleep. And it was a dream, but it felt as though I was woken by a hand on my shoulder and taken to a room and left alone with the most beautiful young woman I could imagine. And I knew without being told that it was the Blessed Virgin Mary. Just to be in her presence, to be in the presence of the purity and intensity of the love flowing from her, was to be in a state of ecstasy greater than I imagined could exist. And she offered to answer any questions I might have. I asked her 4 or 5 questions. And then she spoke to me for a while. And the next morning when I woke up, I knew that it had been Christ that I had met that a year earlier. And I knew that I wanted nothing more than to become as fully and completely a Christian as I possibly could.
What a beautiful grace. Wow.
Amen.
Well, and you had gone out seeking to some other Christian churches, but you had mentioned Mary to some of the pastors.
At that point, after that dream of Mary, I woke up that next morning and I wanted to become as Christian as possible. But I didn't know what a Protestant was. I didn't know what a Catholic was. I didn't know what the difference was. So I really couldn't do much more than open a phone book and look for a local church. So the first couple of churches I went to were Protestant. But as soon as I had introduced myself sufficiently to the pastor, I would ask him, what about the Blessed Virgin Mary? And when he did not acknowledge the high esteem that she merits and her role in salvation, I knew it was no place for me. I knew from that experience of her, I'll tell you one of the questions I asked because it illustrates this point. One of the questions I asked her was essentially, how can this be? You are so exalted, you're so magnificent, because to be in her presence, you know, was to feel, you know, her incredible, incomparable glory. So I said, how can this be? You know, you're so exalted. And her answer was, she kind of shook her head pityingly and said, oh no, you don't understand anything. I'm nothing. I'm a creature. I'm a created thing. He's everything.
Wow. Yeah. So that makes it real.
Yeah. So I knew simultaneously that she was the most exalted creation that God had ever created. And at the same time, in another sense, of course, it's true she's nothing because she's only a creature. But when these Protestant pastors didn't see that she was something more special than any other human being, I knew that I couldn't stay there. So that led me to the Catholic Church.
Praise God. Mm-hmm. Roy, I have to ask you this, especially from your understanding of Judaism and as a Jew, what the events that are occurring now in the Middle East, what's happening on the West Bank, what's your perspective on that? What's your sense of it?
Well, first of all, I do not see any scenario that leads to peace. I don't, frankly, I don't. I don't see any peaceful resolution to the underlying conflict. I think that the conflict is obviously a part of divine providence. It will explode again. And I think that the disengagement, the withdrawal of settlers from some of the occupied territories is actually accelerating that process and mm-hmm. will blow up again.
Well,
I wish I saw something different.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, you see what you see. And I think that's what we just have to continually take this to prayer and to take this to our Lord to help ease our hearts.
But, you know, there is a way in which we should use this actually to buttress our faith, to reinforce our faith, because, you know, it can't be coincidence that the most strife-ridden spot on earth is the spot where salvation took place.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Well said. And I think that's the perspective. Again, your book is filled with so many gems and so many educational moments and so many opportunities for us to ponder our own beliefs and the joy that we have in the fact that God's hand is moving us in this salvation history.
That's right. Everything is providence.
Right. So Roy Shoman, thank you so much for joining us this morning and for offering this book, Salvation is from the Jews.
Thank you for having me. And again, it's published by Ignatius Press, and you can check it on the website, salvationisfromthejews.com.
Okay, just one other quick question before you go, Roy, because I saw this on some of the prep sheets that we had here. Are you working on another book right now?
Well, I have another book that's in the hands of the publisher, Ignatius Press, that's just waiting to be finished being edited and put out. It's a collection of Jewish convert stories, including Rosalind Moss, by the way.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, then hopefully you'll be back with us again soon.
I'd love to. Thank you very much.
All right. Sounds good. God bless, Roy. Thank you so much.
God bless.
Okay. Bye-bye.